Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
What a week for legal news, huh? Lots of legal news this week, and we're going to try to talk about it. This first half hour, I want to cover a few news stories that I saw and some fun things that I saw in the news. And I want to talk about R. Kelly. I think starting at 7:15, I want to talk a little bit about what happened with the child support. And I don't want to beat this to death. And, you know, it was all over. It was in the papers. It was on national news. Everywhere you looked, R. Kelly didn't pay his child support. He went to jail. He got out. Someone paid it for him. But I want to talk a little bit about child support. I want to talk about what happens when a judge gets to the point of throwing someone in jail and how that works. A lot of people out there are receiving child support, and there are a lot of people out there paying child support. And I want to weigh in a little bit on what you do if someone's not paying child support, or if you're on the paying end and you're not able to pay support, and what your obligations are, what your rights are, and how that all works. There's a new statute in Illinois about how to calculate child support. We'll probably talk about that. So from about 7:15 to 7:30, if you have any questions about R. Kelly, child support, or any of those issues, please give us a call, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. As you know, I'm a practicing lawyer, so I could probably answer those questions. And then at 7:30, we're going to be talking about an interesting topic of addiction. And as I said on Brian's crosstalk, one out of five people over the age of 14 is addicted. It's an amazing statistic. The issue of addiction is what has been called to be the most devastating healthcare disaster in the world. It costs more to help people who have been addicts and lost work, in medical expenses, and in death. So it's something that is very, very interesting. And if you aren't addicted, you probably know a family member or friend who does have an addiction issue. And so what we're talking about with a behavioral neuroscientist is the brain. And why do some people drink a drink and they're fine? Some people drink a drink and they have to have 10 drinks. Or they smoke a cigarette and they're addicted for life. Why are people addicted? And is this something that can be controlled? Can it be medicated? And can it be changed and altered? Can it be recognized early on so that you can prevent your child perhaps from being an addict at some point? But with us, we'll be talking to Dr. Judy Grizel, who wrote a book called Never Enough. Fascinating book that I read this week. So we'll be talking to her about 7:30 to 8, and then as normal, we'll be taking your legal questions starting at 8 o'clock and going to 9 o'clock, and I'll try to answer any question that you have about legal news, about topics that are of interest to you in the legal world. If you have issues of credit card debt or breach of contract or traffic court stuff, give me a call here. Again, I'm going to give you the number, 312-981-7200. As I was searching this morning for some just fun stories to fill in the blanks, and if I had some time, I ran into a story, and it said something to the effect of parents and neighbors clash over outdoor daycare. And I read it about 10 times, and I thought, outdoor daycare? What is outdoor daycare? Okay, if anyone knows what this is, and what I'm referring to is Forest Play School on the north side of Chicago. If anyone knows anything about outdoor daycare, I want you to call in if you've got your child enrolled in it, if you've heard of it, if you have an opinion on it. But here's what it is. Forest Play School is an outdoor-only daycare. So what you do is, and this is all four seasons, your children go and they're outside at least 4 hours a day, no matter what the weather, except it has to be over 15 degrees Fahrenheit, only over 15 degrees Fahrenheit, or if there's a wind chill factor, and they play that by ear. Or if there's more than 1 inch of rainfall, which is a lot of rainfall. But otherwise, the kids are bundled up. You drop them off. They go outside. They commune with nature. They learn about the trees and about the animals and about how to do things outside. And the idea, obviously, is to get children to understand nature and the environment and all of those good, healthy, positive things. But listen, would you drop your kid off tomorrow morning in a forest preserve, bundled up for 4 hour class? I just don't understand that. Does anyone Has anyone heard of that? Outdoor daycare. And I was thinking to myself, where do they go for recess? I mean, you know, it was fun going to recess for 10 minutes when you ran outside in the snow, but do they go inside for recess? Anyway, if anyone has any experience with that, let me know, because it sounds goofy to me. I suppose, you know, making children aware of their environment is a good, happy thing. But I don't think I would do that. I just don't think I would. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We're going to be talking about R. Kelly, 981-7200. Welcome back. One of the texters said, it's good, toughen up the kids, throw them outside all day, and sent me a picture of a kid up to their knees in snow. How the cruel are you? How cruel are you? Really? Outdoor daycare. I'm serious. Who thought of that? Who thought of that one? Anyway, let's talk about child support. Let's talk about R. Kelly. R. Kelly, where do we begin? Well, he was released a couple days ago. I've spent some time in jail for not paying $161,000 in past due child support. Apparently, someone anonymously made the payment for him. Must be nice to have people make anonymous payments when you're a multimillionaire, or you should be a multimillionaire, and but maybe by your own actions have become a pauper. I don't know. I don't know what the story is. But in any event, I want to use this sort of as a springboard to talk not necessarily about R. Kelly's dilemma, but about child support in general. You know, in Illinois now, we have a new law that uses what we call income shares to calculate support. It used to be that if you were, let's say, a dad and you weren't living with your children full time and you were visiting the children every weekend and maybe once or twice a week for dinner, you would pay child support and it would be a percentage of your take-home pay based upon the number of children. And that was kind of it. There was really no recalculation, or it was pretty much a standard percentage. And now we have what's supposed to be more fair, but I'm not sure it's working out that way, which you take the both parties' incomes and you put it together and you figure out who makes what percentage of the income. Then there's a set amount of money that supposedly raising two children might cost. And that's on a chart that you can get from the state, and you can get it online. And then the parent that's paying child support pays his percentage. The other party is responsible for her percentage. And you cross-reference those and basically subtract them. And that's what the child support is. And the problem is that it's not always fair, because it's different raising a child in Moline, Illinois, than it is in, let's say, Glencoe. So we find that women, not to say women, because men sometimes have custody of their children, and we know that, but I'm just going to use women, have really been shortchanged, in my view, for getting child support, because you have to pay for the overhead and the food and clothing and those types of things. Dads have to pay money, too. They have to take the children, and they also are buying clothes and doing those things. So, you know, essentially, both parties are a little disgruntled by this law, but, you know, the state of Illinois has done its best. Here's the issue of child support that you need to be aware of. If you're a person who's paying child support, generally speaking, your obligation is written in stone, and it's written in stone in your judgment. So when you get a divorce, it's a divorce decree, but it's also a judgment, which means that you're bound by it. So if it says you, mom, have to pay $200 a week in child support to dad, that's what you have to pay unless and until you go to court and have it changed. Okay, so just because you lose your job, or just because you get a job that's making less money, or just because you get a job that's making more money, your child support doesn't automatically get raised, lowered, or abated. So a lot of people think, oh, I lost my job for a year, I'm not paying child support, I don't owe it because I wasn't working. Not the case. And even if the person who's receiving the support is not taking you back to court, she could take you back to court later after 10 years. So there's no statute of limitations on child support. Could be that you think that she's given you a break and you're fine, but in the end, you will owe that money, and you will owe a lot of money in interest. Every time you don't pay child support, so let's say it's due on March 1st, by April 1st, it's considered to be a judgment against you, meaning it starts to collect interest after 30 days. After 30 days, it starts to collect 9% interest per annum. Well, that is an amazing amount of interest. You can't get that kind of interest anywhere, but you can get it if you don't pay your child support. So you can imagine that if you don't pay support over and over again for a period of 10 years and you add it up and you add that 9%, that can be a huge amount of money. And it's not uncommon for me to have people come to me with child support owing of $150,000. I represent people on both sides of this, so I know sometimes the people come and they owe it. Sometimes the people come and they are owed it. A lot of people don't go back for child support because they don't want to be in court and they don't like the whole process. But at some point they realize, hey, you know what? I could use this money for college. I could use this money for the children. So if you are a person who's paying support and you can't pay it for some reason or another, you need to go to court and file a motion to reduce it or to modify it. And you don't really need a lawyer. It helps to have a lawyer. I know when you're out of work, the last thing you want to do is pay money to a lawyer. But that's the safest thing to do to make sure that you don't have this problem down the line. I've got a case now where the guy owes so much child support that we did the calculations, and if he paid the arrearage every month, he would be about $140 before he paid it off. So the mother is not going to get all her money, and the dad is going to be paying until he dies. Nobody's happy with that at all, especially the children, because the children are grown, and they didn't get the benefit of having that money to pay for their sports and their activities and their clothing and the like. So again, pay your support if you have an obligation. Take it seriously. If you can't pay, pay what you can. Show an effort. Keep very good records of what you are paying. If you're on the receiving side, keep very good records on what's being paid and when it's being paid. And know that down the line, if, for instance, your ex-spouse goes to court and gets a judgment against you for $100,000, she can put a lien on your house. She can take your car. She can stop you from getting a driver's license. She can stop you from getting a passport. She can take your tax refund. And there are even criminal penalties for it, which generally don't come into play. But know that if you come to court and the judge decides, like the judge did in the R. Kelly case, that here's a guy with bodyguards, here's a guy with music on the radio every day, his royalties must be in the thousands every week, he lives at Trump Tower, he's got diamonds the size of a skating rink on his ears, you know, the judge said, no, I'm going to throw you in jail until you come up with the money. And guess what? He came up with the money, because nobody wants to be in Cook County Jail. No one does. That's a horrible place for anybody. Nobody deserves to be there. So that's what happened. And again, judges do not generally like to throw people in jail because they figure, hey, you know what? If you're in jail, you're probably not going to be working and you're not going to be able to find the money to pay. So usually what the judge says is, listen, you're in a situation where you have to come back here with $5,000. You have to borrow it. You have to get a credit card, find the shoebox under the bed and come back here. And if you do that, it's called a purge. And then I'm not going to throw you in jail. And then you're going to get on track. And then we're going to get you to pay your child support. The judge can also make you get a job. That's another thing. If a lot of people are not working, and so the judge will make you apply for 20 jobs a day and come to court with proof that you've made those payments. So child support can be very perilous. And just because someone's not collecting it from you doesn't mean you may not owe it down the line. And believe me, there's going to be a multiplier. Chris, you have a question about child support. How are you?
Hey, Karen. How are you?
Good.
If I remember correctly, you can, even if you're getting unemployment, you can request for them to take that money out.
Yes.
Of your unemployment check.
There's two parts to unemployment. Usually, when you get unemployment, there's a portion that's designated for your dependents. And it's an amount that they think is fair for the dependents. And a lot of times the judges will say, as long as that's going to the dependents, the children, that you don't owe any more money during the time you're unemployed. Now, when you become reemployed, the judge could order you to pay past due support, saying, yeah, they got that little amount of money, but you should have been working. And if it's your fault that you got fired in particular, the judge could say you have to pay back that money that you were ordered to pay. But generally speaking, that dependent pay might be enough to satisfy your support, at least in the interim. Does that make sense
to you? Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I went through it. So that way, when you're unemployed, you don't actually fall in arrears. There is an option.
There is an option. And again, the judge could say when you're up on your feet again, I do want you to pay it back over time. But at least you're not going to jail. You're not going to be sanctioned. You're not going to have all the bad things happen to you. And you're not going to end up in jail with R. Kelly. So
correct. Well, and see, that's the biggest question I got is there's guys I know that have gone to jail for owing 2 or 3 months of child support. How does someone like him have that much money and not be sought after and put in jail?
I'm going to put you on hold because I'm going to have to break in 10 seconds here. But you're absolutely right. People get treated differently. I totally agree. I don't like it. I've got clients who the person should be thrown in jail and they're not thrown in jail. I've got clients who get thrown in jail for $500. R. Kelly should have been thrown in jail. If he has all the money in the world that I think he does and he's not paying his child support, he went to jail, and I don't feel sorry for him one bit. That's my opinion. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Addiction. It's called the most formidable health problem in the world. 1 in 5 over the age of 14 is addicted to something. And whether you're a victim yourself or you know somebody, a family member or a friend who is, it's a topic that has a lot of moving pieces. And the part that I'm going to talk about tonight is how the brain of addicts might be different than the average brain and how we might overcome addiction based on what we know about it. Dr. Grizel is a PhD behavioral neuroscientist with expertise in pharmacology and genetics, whose research focuses on determining the root causes of drug addiction. She is the author of a really fine book called Never Enough. Welcome to the show, Dr. Judy. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. I read the book very, very quickly this week, and it was a great book because it gives you a lot of detail about the brain without it, but it's readable, which is very good because it's very complicated. It's brain surgery, if you will.
It is complicated, and that was my goal, actually. I thought after failing to solve it with my own research and about 25 years of working on the problem, I thought, well, the least I can do is try to explain what we do understand in a way that everybody can understand it. I think so often the scientists are off at their lab benches working on really important problems, and then people are wondering basic questions, but there's not much of a bridge sometimes between the two. So my goal was to make a bridge, or a part of it anyway.
And you did a good job. And one interesting, fascinating fact is that you yourself were a serious addict. Can you tell our listeners briefly, and the point of this is you bring this into the book and you kind of juxtapose your own personal experiences with the stuff that you know now about how the brain works and how the brain gets people addicted and keeps people addicted. Tell us a little bit about some of the issues you had.
Well, by the time I was 23, I had just turned 23, actually, and I had been using about 10 years. I first started with alcohol and then marijuana and then stimulants and basically everything I could get my hands on. So for 10 years, I used as much and as often as I could until by the time I was 22, I had been homeless and kicked out of 3 schools and pretty hopeless and lost. And when I ended up in treatment, kind of by mistake, I thought I was actually going to a spa. This was in the 1980s, so it wasn't so widely understood, I guess. So I didn't know what I was doing, but I ended up in treatment with nurses and not pedicures for sure. I learned that I had maybe a disease of the brain and that I was going to destroy myself if I kept using. And I thought, with kind of understandable determination, if you're somebody like me, you know that, you know, try to take away my drugs. I thought, there's no way I can live without these chemicals because this is all there's worth living for anyway. So I thought, well, I'll solve addiction, which is really hilarious to me now because I was so arrogant and naive, but I somehow, by force of will, I guess, managed to get into finish my undergraduate, which took 7 years in total, and then I went to graduate school for another 7 years, and then I did a 3-year postdoc, and anyway, all of that was focused on understanding the mechanisms of addiction. So what I really wanted to know, and I still want to know, is what's different about the brains of people like me before we ever pick up a drug, and then during the time we're using, and maybe even afterward, that make us respond so differently. And I thought if I could understand what's different about the brain, then I could fix it. So we do understand quite a lot about what's different, and that was the purpose of the book. We haven't been able to fix it yet, but we'll see how that goes.
You're listening to Dr. Judy Grizel, who's the author of Never Enough, about how the brain affects addiction and those issues. Again, you know, these are very complicated issues, and I'm not sure we can explain all of them on the radio. You'd have to read the book to really get a good understanding. But there's a thought that I always had, which is that people who are depressed and people who are anxious use drugs and alcohol as sort of a self-medication, and that's how the addiction comes into play. But having read your book, that's really not the issue at all, is it?
Well, I don't know, Karen. I would say for some people, so let me back up. There's many reasons, and there may be as many reasons to become an addict as there are addicts or alcoholics. I think it is complicated. The head of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism is George Kube, and he says a funny thing about this. He says, you can either be born an alcoholic or drink a lot and become one. So I think there are people, and I was probably one of these, who have a genetic predisposition. They're kind of prone that way. The way we respond to drugs from the very first time we try them is maybe different from other people who are less prone. And sometimes that proneness might take the form of depression or anxiety. So for sure, anxiety is a predictor of alcohol use disorders. But for reasons that I explain in the book, using alcohol a lot also makes you more anxious. So it's kind of a vicious circle. And I think there is some evidence that depression and anxiety and addiction are kind of three sides of the same coin. However, anybody can become an addict if they use enough of any substance. So I think there are many reasons and many pathways. Part of those are biological. Part of those are environmental.
A lot of what you talk about, Dr. We only have a few minutes before we take a break here, but is the adaption that the brain, the adaptive qualities of the brain, so that your brain is always adapting to what you're giving it and what you're exposing it to. And that has a lot to do with addiction, if I can really simplify it. And there was one example that I thought was fascinating. And you say, if the same person goes to a bar every Friday for 10 years and they know they're going to have their three drinks or whatever it is, it's almost like they become accustomed to it, and their brain sets itself up to do what it likes to do, and your brain knows it's going to happen. Then one time, after 10 years, you go instead to a party rather than a bar. There's an idea that if you go to the bar, you might become more intoxicated with the exact same amount of alcohol because your brain is not going into its same adaptive mode that it went into with the routine that you had. I'm probably muddling this a little bit.
No, I think you meant if you go to the party instead of the bar,
right?
You'll
that's right.
get more drunk.
Yes.
Right.
So
yeah,
why would
exactly
that be?
Right.
You're drinking the same amount, you're doing the same thing at the same time, but you're in a different place. Why would your body react differently?
Well, probably the brain's most wonderful attribute is its ability to adapt. And it adapts to all drugs, especially abuse drugs, by producing the exact opposite effects that the drug produces. So, like if you're drinking at the bar, the drug alcohol makes you relaxed and a little euphoric, you'll tend to feel tense and maybe dysphoric before you drink, if you're anticipating it. And because it adapts so well, it uses the environmental cues to predict, oh, she's going to have her three gin and tonics now, so I'm going to get ready by being kind of tense and anxious, so that when I get those gin and tonics, I feel just pretty good. But if I wasn't expecting it, because the brain doesn't know, you know, we're in a different context, maybe it would have a bigger effect. So the bottom line, the core principle that you're talking about is that any drug you take regularly, the brain produces the opposite effect of. And for that reason, you're tolerant and dependent and craving. And in this case, you know, the drinking at a party might make you so much more intoxicated with the same amount that you'd be, you know, less able to drive, less able to control your emotions or have reasonable thoughts, those kinds of things.
Very interesting. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking some more with Dr. Judy Grizzell, the author of a great book, which is Never Enough. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. We're talking about addiction with Dr. Judy Grizzell, author of Never Enough. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Grizzell.
Thanks.
So let's talk a little bit about ranking the addictive qualities of different drugs. How would you rate them as far as what are the ones that are most addictive?
Well, so addiction is probably five main criteria, tolerance and dependence and craving that we've talked about. Also, it has to be harmful, so it hurts the user and usually, or maybe always, the people around them and society in general. And finally, there's denial of the problem. So mostly we focus on the first three, or the first four, I guess, in saying what's most addictive. Certainly, the habit forming dependence, where if you take away the drug, you have withdrawal, is most quickly developed to nicotine. So cigarettes are wildly addictive. In early studies, before we had, you know, advertising and it was clear that they were bad for your health, I think there was a study where something like 96% of people who smoked 7 cigarettes in their life developed a habit.
Wow.
So, you know, nothing is really that addictive. It's a really compelling drug. I think in terms of harm, also nicotine is at the top of the list, closely followed by alcohol. So it's interesting that the two legal drugs are
the
most harmful.
Right. I think you said in your book that nicotine takes away 15 years of a person's life.
Yeah, no, it's really it's tragic. But I think opiates are certainly very addictive. So if you, it's very, you know, the first time you use opiates, your brain begins adapting, and it makes it more and more likely that you're going to crave opiates again. And so you can really fall into a habit so quickly with opiates, more quickly than with alcohol, although I think alcohol has caused more damage by far overall, and it still is the case, you know, each year in the U.S. that alcohol's cost more lives and health and all of that. Cocaine and the stimulants are also very, very addictive. So they are drugs that everybody likes, and so anybody could develop a habit to those, and it's more likely in a way. And nicotine is a stimulant as well. So that general class of drugs is addictive. I think, you know, all of the drugs we're talking about are drugs that produce pleasure, so we like the way they feel, and anything that gives us that feeling of pleasure can be addictive.
Is it true, though, that at some point it's not so much the pleasure that you're seeking, but when you're an addict, is that you just want to feel normal because your overindulgence of these things make you feel agitated, as you said, irritable maybe, and you, that's why you need that fix in order not to feel pleasure anymore, but to not feel bad.
Oh, that's absolutely right, Karen. So you, the first time you use, it's sort of a nice little luxury, you know, like a special treat. And that luxury, if you do it regularly, becomes a habit. And then there's less pleasure, and it's more habitual. And then habits become compulsions, as you pointed out, we're using not so much to feel the good feelings, but to avoid feeling the bad feelings we feel when the drug is not there. And that's dependence. So taking away the drug, you feel less than good. So you're using just to feel okay. And opiate addicts, for instance, almost never get high. They're only avoiding feeling sick. And then once you have a compulsion, you really have an addiction because, so what started out as sort of a nice little treat, now it, just to feel normal and just to feel okay and just to get through the day, you need the drug. So you're not really benefiting in so much as you're just avoiding misery.
Interesting. Can we take a call? Is that okay, Dr. Grizel?
Sure, okay. That'd be great.
Hi, John. You're calling from Gurnee. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I think we lost Judy. Ben? Anyway,
oh,
okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. We'll get her back on in 1 minute here. Go ahead and tell us what your issue is.
I run a company and I'm work every day, pretty hard, and I'm available to my company day and night. But then what happens is that there'll be certain nights when I drink way too much in excess, and I'm wondering why that happens certain times. It's like, I know why it happens, but it's like, it just, I'm wondering, so.
Okay, so I'm sorry, you're saying you're not planning on having a drink, but then you all of a sudden.
No, then I have one, then two, then.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you hear any of that?
I heard the last part. I think I got the idea. So the first part is what causes us to pick up when we intend not to. And really there's three main reasons. One of them is stress, which is prevalent, so that's one reason it's so hard to stay clean. Another one are the environmental cues that we were just talking about, Karen. So going to the bar, if you decide to go to that bar that you usually drink in but don't want to have a drink, once you get in there, you really feel like having them. So seeing your friends who are drinking, smelling the smoke, whatever it is. And then the third thing, which I think the caller is talking about, is the taste of the drug. So it's easy. I was very much this way. I can remember saying, well, I'm not going to drink today. And then I would have, smoke a little weed or just have one beer, I thought. And the next thing I know, I was kind of off to the races. So I think that once you taste the drug, especially if you are kind of on your way to having a habit, it's really hard. It sort of sets up the craving. So I'm the same way. I haven't had a drink in a long time because I think once I get a little bit in my system, I think all bets would be off.
That's right. We only have a few minutes for this fascinating topic, but I want to talk about just, moving forward here. For children, smoking marijuana can be dangerous to children. I'm going to bullet point some of these as quickly as I can. Is that fair to say that you shouldn't let your kids smoke marijuana? If they are, you should be of concern.
Well, good luck not letting your kids smoke marijuana.
Right.
I don't
exactly.
mean to be cynical there, but I think, I don't think there's much chance of that. And I think kids, to be fair, pick up on what we do more than what we say. So if we're drinking, for instance, we're enjoying our drug, and then we tell them, but don't you enjoy your drug? I mean, they look at the effects of alcohol that they see around them, and they're not so into that. They're not so into nicotine either. They see that as a problem. But they are smoking a lot of weed, and it's true. If you could stop them, good luck. I think that it would be helpful because while their brain is developing, it's particularly vulnerable to the impacts of any drug, including marijuana. We have clear evidence that marijuana alters the trajectory of brain development, and that affects your behaviors for a lifetime. So you would be more prone to using other drugs of abuse and using them at higher doses, for one thing, which would set you up for subsequent addictions, but also maybe anxious and have a depressive mood state. So there's a lot of evidence that if you could wait until your brain is finished developing, which is about age 25, but even 24 is better than 23, and 23 is better than 22, so as long as possible, to let the brain kind of get the circuits settled, then the drug would have less deleterious effects.
And of course, when you're that age, maybe you have better decision making skills, and you may decide not to do those things in the first place.
Yeah, which is kind of a circular work for me. I don't know. I think it's a tall order, and I think you know, I think education is helpful, and I think kids would be maybe like to know about what the effects are long term.
Yeah,
hopefully, we'll have the research for that.
I think that's a good thing. Just we only have a few minutes here. You know, again, I hear people all the time. Well, just stop taking the drug. Well, just stop eating so much. Just stop doing this. You know, like there. You know, this is a disease that we're talking about, but there are people like you who were in the midst of a horrible bunch of addictions. You just didn't have one. You had a bunch of them going on. And it turns out, you know, you're a brilliant woman. You went and you got all this great education and you've cured yourself, or at least you're a recovering addict. And the idea is that who are the people that overcome and who are the people that don't? Are there certain qualities that you see, not maybe necessarily in the brain here, because we probably don't know the answer to that, but are there certain people? Is it a support system? Is it some kind of internal motivation? What is it that turns people around and keeps people off of the drugs?
Well, I don't think I was cured, because if I was cured, I would be able to use normally, and I don't think that I would be able to. Yeah, no, that's okay. I just wanted to be clear. I don't know the answer to that. It's a really important question. One of the interesting things about this disease is that the worse off you are when you're sort of diagnosed, the better your chances, which is kind of upside down from other diseases where maybe the smaller the tumor is, the better you are off. So I don't think that we know what are the factors, but for me it involved telling the truth about myself to myself, you know, and looking at my life honestly, which is really hard to do because we talked about denial being one of the core symptoms. And then I had to be willing to change, which I was provisionally willing, we could say. I explained that a little bit in the book. And then I used a lot of help. So I've also been really fortunate to have, you know, support around me. My family was supportive, and I had, you know, counseling and treatment and a halfway house. So I think it was a kind of a community effort in my case.
And we have literally 30 seconds. People who are with loved ones who have addiction, tough love. You show them love, acceptance, kindness. Give me just a real bullet point.
I think addicts have to be held responsible for their actions. I don't think they should be to blame. So I think tough love is better than enabling. My parents kicked me out of the house actually when they realized that my drug use wasn't going to stop. And I think that helped me realize the truth about myself more quickly. But they were also loving. So I think it's a fine line. It's not easy.
Dr. Judy Grizel, thank you so much for joining us. Her book is Never Enough. It's available on Amazon. And is there a website that you can give quickly for us?
Yes. You can look up Judy Grizel at Bucknell University and find my website.
Thank you so much.
Or you can write to me at neverenoughdrugs@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, the stories
that
matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN.
She's legally blonde and brilliant. Karen Conti, attorney at law, is taking your legal questions right now. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200.
Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I'm on the law in a law one. I'm on the law in a law one. I needed money cause I had none.
Welcome back. For the next hour, we're going to be taking your legal calls. So give us a call here, 312-981-7200, or text it 981-7200. Any topic you have, if you have something you saw in the news that you want to discuss, something that we've already talked about, or just a legal question that you've always had and harbored and wanted to ask a lawyer, I'll try my best. I can't always answer everything. Sometimes I need to go and refer to my books and refer to something else. Sometimes I will refer you to another lawyer. But if you have a question that you'd like to ask me, not on the radio, I'm always happy to talk to you or to exchange emails with you. The best way to call me at the office during the week is 312 312- 1-800-332-7800. It's good. Put this in your phone because you don't always need a lawyer. But when you do, or someone in your family or one of your friends needs a lawyer, I may not be the lawyer for you, but at least I can steer you in the right direction. I have a list of very trusted, close colleagues that I work with on estate planning, criminal law, disability, unemployment, workers' comp, personal injury, medical malpractice, any of those areas that I don't practice in, I can refer you to somebody, hopefully in your area, who I know is going to take care of you, I know is going to do the right thing, is competent and nice and kind, and people that I will definitely feel good about referring to you. So if you want to contact me at the office, it's 312-332-7800, or you can email me, which is even better sometimes because then I can give you that information very quickly by referring you to the lawyer with the name and the address and the phone number and the website. And that sometimes that's faster. And that email address, again, put this in your phone so you have it, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Ask Karen, K-A-R-E-N, Conti, C-O-N-T-I. We got some calls coming in, and while Ben is taking your calls and kind of he writes a little blurb up on the screen so I know what it's about, I'm going to talk a little bit about there was a lawsuit that was in the news that I thought was a little bit interesting, and it's Gwen Paltrow, the actress. She was skiing in Utah, apparently, and we don't know exactly what happened, but there was a scuffle on the hill. Someone ran into somebody, and both parties fell down. There was a lawsuit filed a couple weeks ago by a gentleman, and he said that she plowed into him. He sued her for $3.1 million, saying that he sustained a brain injury, broken ribs, etc. And this week, I read that Gwen Paltrow countersued him and said that he was the one who was behind her. She was down on the hill. He was above her on the hill, and he ran into her from behind, and so that he, in fact, was the person at fault. So the question is, you know, what is it about filing a counterclaim? How do you do that? Why do you do that? And then who's liable for something like this? Generally speaking, the best defense is an best offense is a defense, and lawyers know that. And so in a case like this, Gwen Paltrow probably wasn't going to bring a lawsuit. But once she was sued, the idea is that you have to then make your claims. And her claim is, hey, wait a minute, don't sue me. You're the one who ran into me. And when you go in front of a jury and he's asking for $3.1 million, maybe in part because she's a celebrity and thinks that she's got deep pockets, she wants to be able to say, no, in fact, you're the one who hurt me. This makes levels the playing field a little bit during the litigation, and it's helpful in settlement because this gentleman thinks maybe he's going to file a suit and settle quickly with Gwen Paltrow because she's rich. Now he's got something to lose. He may have to, you know, she's suing him back for millions of dollars because she was injured as well. Generally speaking, this is sort of like a car accident, really. There's no real law on ski accidents, but the person who does the rear ending is generally responsible. And here's why. Even if she was standing still on the ski slope, and that was a dangerous thing to do because people were skiing downhill, he still had the obligation to avoid her. So he's going down the hill, he sees her, he needs to be able to move to the side and avoid her. And it may have been negligent for her to be there, but it was his problem for not stopping in time. So my guess is if it's as she says it is, which is he came from behind and wiped her out in a fall, then he's going to be responsible for her damages. And as far as his damages go, you know, there may be some liability, but probably not a whole lot. Again, we don't know the facts. We're just hearing what the pleadings are. And I thought that was a little bit of an interesting twist to things. All right, let's go to the lines. Let's talk. Go to Mike. That's 981-7200, 981-7200. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you, Karen?
Good. Tell me what your issue is.
Nice to talk to you. Anyway, listen, I'll try to keep this brief. I injured my left hand about 3.5 years ago working working, okay? And I had to have two operations in order to get it right. And during that time, which was a seven-month period, I had to use my right hand for everything. And thusly, the doctors told me that I overused it, okay? Three of my fingers and my right hand are useless, okay, right now, okay? And I did sign a workman's comp settlement, okay, with my former employer. But now I'm having all these issues with my right hand, and I'm going to have another surgery, at least kind of, hopefully it'll get it right where I'll be able to use my right hand normally again. And I was wondering if I have any legal recourse against my former employer.
Okay, so let me just ask you, and you're a little bit blurry here, a little bit murky. It sounds like you're underwater. So if you can maybe talk right into your phone a little bit better. Okay.
Okay.
So here's my question: your the hand that you received the compensation for, that's done, and you're settled, and you can't do anything.
Oh, I'm fine.
But
yeah,
so
I'm fine
with
that.
It's the other hand, and is it because of some repetitive workforce action that you're doing? How did you get it injured? How was it injured?
No, I injured it because I had to use, during the time that my left hand was in a cast,
yes,
which was 7 months, I had to use my right hand for everything, okay? And the doctors told me that I overused it. And three of my fingers, my little finger, my ring finger, and my middle finger are useless now,
okay,
because of that, okay? And I have to have surgery in order to hopefully correct it and get use out of my hand again.
Okay.
And I was wondering, even though I did sign a workman's comp settlement for my left hand for the work injury, I was wondering if I have any legal recourse.
Got it. Okay, Michael, I'm going to put you on hold for a minute. I'm going to answer your question. The answer is I'm not sure. But this is interesting because if it stemmed from that first incident, so let's say he got it stuck in a machine, he got a cast on his hand, and during that time he was using his other hand to compensate. Generally speaking, all damages and all injuries that arise from that one accident should have been dealt with at that time. Okay, so the lawyer, you know, maybe you didn't mention to your lawyer, Michael, that you were having trouble with the other hand because you were using it in a way that you never had before, and it probably should have been taken care of with that first incident. And if you signed off on the settlement, it may be that you waived your rights to go after the injuries to that other hand. However, maybe there's an argument to be made that you didn't and weren't aware that these problems happen until after you sign the settlement. And if that's the case, and if you can prove that it's relating to what happened, it could be that you can make an argument that you still have a claim. Again, the idea is you're going to need to talk to a very good workers' compensation attorney to make sure that you know, there's a good argument. And I'm leaning on the idea that you probably waived it. Unless, like I said, the injuries really manifested themselves much further down the line and that you didn't know about it during the time period where you still had this other claim pending. Hope that answers your question. But again, you know, go back to your lawyer who filed the initial suit. If you need a workers' compensation lawyer, I have a great woman who I refer everyone to. She does defense work. She did defense work for years, so she knows how to defend these cases, and now she does the petitioner side, which is what you call the people who bring the claims. So give me an email at WGN@AskKarenConti.com, and I can send you her contact information. You're listening to WGN. This is a Karen Conti show. We're taking your calls, 981-7200. Welcome back. We're taking your calls, 981-7200, or text them at 981-7200. I've got the phone lines are ringing and ringing. It's good. I'm going to try to get to all of you. Steve, hold on. I'm going to get to Pat. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi.
Good.
Hi, Karen. How you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Well, my son, he's a young man who has my granddaughter, obviously, and the couple, they're not married. But he hasn't been. Yeah, she's 2 years old, my granddaughter, and I need to know can my son make payments to the state automatically taken out of his check, so that this way he and does he have to pay rear for the past 2 years of payments?
Pat, let me ask you a couple questions. I take it your son is not living with the mother, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And she hasn't gone to court, and neither party has gone to court to ask for child support or anything like that,
nope.
Right? Okay.
Nope.
Now, here's the reason why he should do this. And a lot of people don't do this because they figure, hey, she's not asking for it. I don't have to pay it, and I won't ever get hit up for it. If things go bad in the relationship, she might go to court and say, I want cost of labor and delivery. I want back child support. I just never got around to going to court, okay? And a judge could say, yes, you have to pay back child support based upon what your income was for those 2 years. The best thing to do is to get this taken care of, and I tell everyone to do this from both standpoints. You want the visitation, and we call it parenting time now. We don't call it visitation. The parenting time should be in writing. Who's paying for what? Who's providing insurance? Who's paying the uncovered medicals? You know, all of those things should be in what we call a parenting agreement. So either party can file what we call a parentage action. It's not a divorce, obviously, because they were never married, but it's almost exactly the same. And you say, I want to declare paternity. Probably he's on the birth certificate, so that's not an issue.
Yeah.
Granddaughter maybe even has his name. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Okay. So that's not an issue. And then you ask the judge to determine support, and you ask the judge to determine parenting time and all of those other issues. And basically, what's a good idea is you get a lawyer, and this is what I would do if I represented your son. I would call her up and say, listen, you know, I'm doing this not to, you know, drive a wedge between us, but I think we both should have a parenting agreement so that we both know and we're on the same page, and I want to pay and I want to take my share, and I want, you know, this all to go amicably. So I would immediately draft up a parenting agreement and give it to her, and maybe she would get a lawyer. She doesn't have to, but if she does, we would look it over. Some of it's very standard. And we'd go into court, and we'd basically enter it in court. The judge, if there's no disagreement, doesn't even really have to get involved in it. And then you would have a roadmap for how things are going to work. Who pays for daycare? You know, even college, you sort of put in there that, you know, you consider different factors when it comes to college. Even though your child's 2 years old, it starts you thinking about saving for college. So all of those things get put into it, and it'll be based upon her income and your son's income, and we can run a child support analysis, and then we can, yes, have it deducted directly from the employer, which is nice. A lot of guys or girls, you know, will say, you know, I don't like that. It's coming right out of my paycheck. You do like it, and here's why. You don't have to write that check every week. You don't have to forget to write it, you know. And what if you have a bad week and you don't have it and then you get behind? So it just goes right automatically into the state disbursement unit, which is a place in the state where all the money goes, and then it gets put into, you know, gets sent out to the people who have the children, and it keeps track of it for you. So that would be a very good thing to do. And if you want somebody in your area and your county to help you do that, send me an email. I'll be happy to refer you to someone. This is something I can do as well. So depending on what county, it looks like you may be in the western or northwestern. But
yeah, we're out by DeKalb County.
Okay, so DeKalb County, yeah. I have some people out there who I refer cases to. But anyway, I hope that answers your question, Pat, and good luck and enjoy your granddaughter.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, take care. And let me give out my email address. That's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. But right now we're taking calls here, 981-7200. Let's go to Steve. Hi, Steve. Thanks for holding.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
So I'm a young photographer, and I've been ramping things up. But for the first time ever, I'm having to take somebody's small claims because they breached the contract. And they never paid me, so I have to sue them for work already completed that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a rough one, but I've never done this before. I've never liked the idea of taking somebody to court, but I looked everything up, and I looked at the paperwork, and I'm just not sure what I should put it in the form of what he breached, you know, what he did.
Okay.
For the court to take a look at it.
And what can I ask, just curious, was it a wedding that you did? Was it a portrait? Like, what was it that he didn't pay for?
So this was going to be a 6-month marketing agreement where I was going to handle his social media, do all the analytics, as well as doing photography for him to boost his social media and make everything look good across his platforms.
Great. And so what happened? At what point did he stop paying?
So he gave me his credit card information. He said, I met him in person. He signed everything. He said, charge it tomorrow. That's going to be where the money is. And the following day, the day I was supposed to charge him was the first day I was shooting for him. I got to location, said, hey, card didn't go through. He said, don't worry, I'll write you a check tomorrow. We'll meet over the weekend. And it just never happened.
Okay.
And I can't deliver the photos to him because I never got payment. But okay. Now I'm stuck with the work that I did for him.
Got it. Okay. I was just going to say, because sometimes I tell people, you know, don't give him the product until you get the payment. But you already have that under control. So here's what you do. What county does he live in or work in?
He lives and works in Cook. I live in DuPage.
Okay. I'm sorry. What county does he live in?
Cook, Chicago.
Okay. So you probably will go to Cook County. You go to the clerk's office, you ask for the paperwork, and I'm going to talk really fast here because we have to take a break. And you get a small claims thing. Okay, so it's going to be a breach of contract. You're going to attach the written contract that you had. I take it you have a written contract, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You attach it, you say he breached the contract, he paid this, he didn't pay this, he owes you this, and then you give it to them. You're going to have to pay some money for the sheriff to go out and serve him, and then there mm-hmm. will be a court date set. You will show up at that court date with all of your information, all of your facts, all of your documentation to show that he breached the contract, which is simple because he didn't pay you what he said he would pay you, and you tell the court, I signed this on this day, he signed it on this day, I did this work, he never paid, he tried to write me a check, blah, blah, blah. You explain it to the judge, and hopefully you'll get a judgment entered against him. The problem with that is then you have to collect it, which means that you're going to have to then take it the next step. Hopefully, if he has a judgment against him, he doesn't want it on his credit report, and he will end up paying you. Hopefully, he'll come to court with a check and just pay you. But that's my best guess, and it really is pretty user-friendly to use small claims. But it may take a few court calls to get the job done. If you have any other questions, I have some good websites. I can give you a link to help you out. And you can email me, and I'm going to put you on hold. Good luck, Stephen. WGN at Ask Karen Conti. We're going to take a break now. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
You can put away your tissues, because here's the answer to your legal issues. 30 years experience in this town. Karen Conti wears the legal crown, and it's about to go down.
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti wearing the legal crown here. Not really. I'm not wearing the legal crown. Anyway, this is the time to get in your legal questions. We have a nice conversation going. 981-7200. And if you don't get a chance or you want to talk a little more intimately, you can call me at the office, 312-332-7800. You may get a voice machine, and it's confidential, and leave your detailed message if you would. Don't just leave your name. Just tell me a little bit about your issue, where you live, and what kind of information you want or what kind of referral you want. That's the best way to do it so I can get back to you in the details. You can also email me at WGN at AskKarenConti.com. All right, here we go. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. Tell me your question.
I received distribution of a will from my grandmother about a year and a half ago. My father passed away 8 years ago, and his two brothers and his sister, and one of his brothers was the person whose distribution of the will. I've never got a codicil of the will to really know what my portion of the will would be to me. Is it by law that they should send me a codicil of the will?
Okay, so codicil, probably not the right word. You want a copy of the will. You want to see what the will says, correct?
Correct.
Okay. If it's truly a will, it will have been filed in court. A will has to generally be probated, meaning that it's filed in the court, probably in the county where the decedent died, and resided.
Cook County.
Okay, so you would go and you can go online and see if you can find it there, or you'd go down to the clerk's office and put the name in. You can have someone help you with it, and you should be able to get a full copy of the will. If you were a beneficiary necessary, an error of any type. You should have gotten some notices about things. Now, that doesn't always happen because the executors don't always do what they're supposed to do. But generally speaking, if you were to take under that will and you were a person that was named to take a benefit, you should have been given copies of things. And if you haven't, it's either because the person didn't do the right thing or because you're not an heir in the will. You're not named in the will.
Is there a statute of limitations of how long I have to go about this before that would run out?
Yeah.
And by law, should they have given me and sent me a copy of the will so I know what how the distribution
they
was
have,
being put?
Yeah, they have a certain number of weeks to do that. I don't know, as I sit here, what it is, if it's 6 months or what it is. But it's a certain number it's a certain limited time that they have to give you this stuff. And some people violate that. The issue was, you know, is there a statute of limitations for you to take under a will that maybe you had a right to take under? Basically, if the will, if the whole estate is wrapped up, you might be too late. So I would say you should go look at the court file, get the entire court file, see if the will's in there, see if you are an heir, a beneficiary under the will. And then you can actually look at the court file to see if they're still going to court. Are they still getting the assets together? They might be selling assets. They might be putting it together. They might be paying debts. And it may not be done yet. So at least you can track what's going on with it.
Right. They already given me a portion. They give me $65,000. But I've never received anything about how things are being distributed. I mean, I have some cousins, and I'm the grandson. And like I said, my dad passed away 8 years ago. So I don't know if he was supposed to get something. What he was supposed to get was supposed to go to me because I'm the only son of his.
Okay.
And you're saying the best thing to do is go. And like you say, would it have to be a will?
You know, if it's a trust, it's not going to be probate. You're not going to find it. If it's a will, you will be. So I don't know if you even know that. But the other thing is, if you know the lawyer who's representing any of these people, the executor perhaps, do you know if there's a lawyer involved, you can actually call the lawyer and say, you know, this is who I am, and I'm just wondering what's going on. Just let me say, and I'm going to put you on hold because I'm going to try to get to some other calls. The idea is that these estates take a long time to resolve. I have one right now that I'm dealing with some litigation on that has been open for 8 years, and it's still not resolved, and now nobody has gotten their benefits, the beneficiaries have not gotten their portion of the estate yet. And I don't know what's taking so long. I don't understand it, but it takes a long time sometimes. So don't think that, you know, everything happens very quickly because it doesn't. But that's the best way to do it. Look and see, find the source yourself, read it, and see what's going on. All right, Chris, let's go to Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a question about child support.
Hey, thanks, Karen, for taking the call. You mentioned the state disbursement a little bit ago earlier
Yes.
in your show, and that is definitely the way to do state or financial money disbursement. So you were 100% correct on that with child support. My son's 17, turning 18 soon. Just wondering, do I need legal representation to get the state disbursement to stop coming out of my paycheck automatically? Does that organization or state entity just do that automatically on its own?
Okay.
How do I stop that money from coming out of my check?
Okay, that's a good question. First thing you would do, Chris, is to look at your divorce decree or look at the last child support order that was entered in court. Because now what we do is we provide for an end date. When I get somebody divorced, I always say the last day that you will pay support, and then I put that date in there, 18 years, you know, whatever, you do the math. And so that by its own terms, it should stop. Now, that doesn't mean that, is your employer withdrawing money?
Yeah, the employer's withdrawing things automatically,
okay.
And I was divorced 10 years ago.
Okay.
There is no end date stipulation
okay.
in any of the paperwork.
Too bad. That's too bad. So you're going to have to go to court and file a quick motion to say, I'd like to terminate child support. My child's 18, or the day that he graduates high school, whatever, you know, and then you're going to get an order that terminates support, and then you're going to send it to your employer's going to have it, and the state disbursement unit is going to have it. Hopefully you can do it by agreement with your ex. you know. And again, you know, it's hard to do these things without a lawyer just because it's hard to navigate the system. It's possible that you do a motion to terminate and the judge is going to order it right away, but you will have to serve your ex. You will have to get a court date. You will have to go to the Daily Center. You have to stand in line. You have to wait in court, and you have to wait your turn, get a court order, and then do the right thing with it. So it might be good to hire a lawyer to maybe help you along with that process.
Sounds good. Okay. That's exactly what I needed to know. Thank you so
okay,
much.
Chris.
Have a great week.
All right. Take
Thank
care. You.
You
too.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's go to Steve. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a legal question.
Hi, Karen. Great show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I work for a delivery service, and I had a bad knee injury about 4 years ago. Had surgery, and that didn't go well, so ended up I had a knee replacement.
Okay.
And they're working on the settlement now, and I'm kind of held back because I'll probably need another. I'm only 52. Probably need another knee replacement sometime in my life. How would you suggest I go about this settlement?
Okay. I take it you have a lawyer, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And your lawyer is aware that you will probably have to have a second knee replacement. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And hopefully that's in a medical record so your lawyer can get a full settlement for all of that. Because once you settle, and we had another caller who had an issue that kind of was related to the first one, and I'm afraid that he may have waived it by settling the case, you can't go back to court when you need that new replacement and say, hey, this one's also because I was injured at work. You're going to have to wrap it all up in this one settlement, and you need proof that you need that new, you will probably need that knee replacement, and you need to have your lawyer fight for the extra money available to do that. Okay? But so you need to strong arm that, make sure your lawyer understands that you're looking to get compensation for that as well. Okay?
Okay. And besides another knee replacement, what about if I'm not unable to work? Should that be also included?
And that's a hard thing to do because it's speculative. You don't really know, right? So
right.
Until you get to that point in time, you know, and you're not going to be able to make that claim. So this is the hard thing about settling, because once you settle the case, you can't go back. So again, if something worsens or if the workplace causes you to have another re-injury or worse problems, you can always go back to court on that because your workplace caused that pre-existing condition to get worse. So perhaps
okay.
you would have the right to go back, but you should talk to your workers' comp lawyer about all those issues in detail so you know exactly what would need to be proven if, for you know, unfortunately, you couldn't work your job because you work a very physical job. You know, if you're a desk person, it wouldn't matter, but, you know, you need your knees to do your job,
right.
and you want to be protected. So good luck to you. I hope it works out. I hope you get a good settlement for yourself. Okay?
Me too.
All right.
Just
all right,
a quick
Steve.
Shout out for okay. my grandma's going to be 100.
Oh, wow. I think it was 104. I think he said that. Wow, that's amazing. We're going to have to take a break, but I'm going to get to all of you really fast. I'm Joe, and I got Nancy, and I got some texters. But give me a call here, 981-7200, 981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Still got a few minutes here, so get your calls in, 981-7200 or text to 981-7200. Hey, let's go to Nancy. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. I'm so happy to be able to talk to you.
I'm happy to talk to you, too.
Thank you. I need your help. I don't know what type of attorney my daughter may need.
Okay.
In 2013, my daughter was 38 years old, type A personality. She worked at a major hospital as a ward secretary, okay? She taught people software. She even worked on the floor when they were shorthanded. She started not feeling well, and where she would just pass out for no reason. Fast forward, she has POTS. She has autoimmune disease. It's just a nightmare. We've been everywhere from Rochester, Minnesota, to Nashville, Tennessee, to all the specialists in Chicago. Okay. During that first year, 2013 to 2014, they kept pushing her disability insurance through work. She was getting $1,700 a month. She was unable to work, okay? Now, you have to also understand that her mind was just She was not the person she was. She couldn't keep anything straight. She couldn't be alone 24/7. And so she's getting the $1,700 a month. They had a second party, the insurance company, that was supposed to be watching all this, and they were pushing her to file for Social Security disability. At the 12-month point, when we're not getting answers, but this wasn't getting any better, it was getting worse, her medical conditions, and I say with an S because she's got like 8 of them total now, okay? We filed for Social Security disability. She was awarded that. As soon as we got the award letter, which took 3 or 4 months, we sent that to that second party that the insurance company had supposedly helping us through this, and they did nothing. Okay, they got it the day after we got it. We faxed it to them.
Okay, hold on. This is getting real like technical and complicated. Can I get to the end? Did they put her on? She was on temporary disability.
Right.
Now, was there an option to go on permanent disability with the insurance company?
Yes, there was, but they were telling us you need to file. So we did. We got the approval, and we let them know right away. They continued paying her for 6 months.
Okay.
$1,700, even though we told them everything up front, okay? Now what they've done is they have, we overpaid you. So you've got to pay that back. So
are
the
$200,
$250 a month she's supposed to get, they're keeping to pay back that 6 months of overpayment.
Okay. And they're saying they overpaid because she was also receiving Social Security disability.
Right. But okay. We told them up front in that second party, and we even faxed it to them, too, not just to their second party watchers, you know.
Okay. So, you know, this is, like, very technical. This is the kind of thing that I have to read the fine print, and I would have to read everything to understand what your rights are, because insurance law is very contract-based, and you have to read the fine print.
Oh, I know, because from what we read in it, they have no liability whatsoever.
Yeah, and frankly, my real educated guess, knowing how this works with the temporary disability and with the permanent disability, is that they can set off anything that they want. Is there a set off for the fact that she's getting Social Security disability? That's the narrow question that you need to ask an insurance lawyer. And if you, when we hang up, I'm going to give you my email address. And there's an insurance lawyer who's really good at these things. You may have to pay him a consultation fee, but he will be able to tell you, probably based upon this insurance company. He'll probably even know the insurance company. Do you have a right to, if you get Social Security disability from the government, does that get set off from your disability payments through an insurance carrier? Okay, that's the narrow question. I can't answer that, but that lawyer will be able to do that. So I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to read my email address to you, okay?
Thank you.
All right, Nancy. Some of these are really technical, and it's hard to answer because I have to read the fine print. Nancy, give me an email or email at WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Okay, let's go to Pam. Hi, Pam. Welcome to WGN.
Hi. Can you hear me okay? I'm on my car phone.
Yeah, I hear you perfectly.
Okay. My question is, my son went through a custody battle with his girlfriend, and he primarily has my granddaughter. And the thing is, we haven't seen her since September, and we're wondering about the abandonment law. If he can have full custody of her where she wouldn't be in any part of it. She's been away for September, so this month it'll be 6 months.
I'm sorry, so the mother has been away for 6 months?
Yeah, she's into drugs. She'd failed a drug test back in September, and with that, she left.
Okay.
Basically, she was under supervision care, seeing her daughter every other weekend. Once she was 6 months drug-free, she would get her every other weekend and one night a week.
Okay, and that's...
Go ahead.
You know, I'm going to put you on hold because I like your dog, but your dog isn't really adding much to the conversation.
Oh, hang on. Just a second.
That's okay. I love dogs. But dogs, you know, dogs on the radio, not so much. Pam, so here's my thought on this. First of all, you know, it's too bad that this little girl's not going to have a mother. And so I always say you want to make sure if someone is on drugs and all that, obviously you're not going to give your daughter to someone who's doing drugs. And she's caught up in an addiction. She's not going to be a good parent. But, you know, it's really important that hopefully she gets some help so that this little girl is not raised without a mother. That's just a very sad thing. It affects children long term. I know you think she's no good. I know you think she might be a danger. And I'm not saying give her to the mother, but make sure that she has, you know, basically exhausted all her resources to try to get better before you take action to have her parental rights terminated. And that's what you're talking about. I'd have to look at the statute to see exactly what needs to be proven. Generally speaking, there has to be a period of time that goes by. I don't think 6 months is enough, but if you email me, I'll pull up the statute and I'll look and see. Generally, it can be proven, you can terminate parental rights in a number of ways. If some parent has not shown an interest in a certain time period, if the parent hasn't paid child support, if the parent is convicted of a crime, and there's all kinds of other things in the statute that would allow you to terminate parental rights. At that point, if you move and go to court and terminate parental rights, then you can't get child support. You can't get her to contribute to anything, and she will lose her rights altogether forever. Again, before you do that, you want to think twice about the ramifications of that, because sometimes people, young people, will come around and they'll get help, and then they become available to be a parent. And maybe she's not going to be a primary parent, but at least she would be able to see the child. Really sad situation. I'm really sorry to hear that. I want to just go quickly. We only got a minute, but I've got someone, Dexter, emailed me and asked me the question. When I sign something, I'm going to kind of paraphrase it. He said, in the terms and conditions of a contract, it says that all disputes have to be arbitrated. And is that enforceable? And the answer is it's probably enforceable. And the problem with that arbitration clause is that, let's say that you have an insurance, that's probably a bad example. If you have a contract with somebody, some company, and they say you can't go to court and enforce your rights, but you have to go to arbitration. Arbitration costs money. Courts generally don't. You need a filing fee, but the judges are free. Lawyers are not free. But arbitration clauses require people to come up with money to arbitrate with a panel of maybe AAA arbitration. A lot of construction contracts have mandatory arbitration. So basically, you're kind of in a bad place, because if you've been wronged by a contract, it's very, very expensive to bring an arbitration. But if there's one in there, you're probably bound by it. Do I have any time? Nope, got to take a break. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week. Hopefully when we get back next week, it'll be a little warmer.